Oh, it's certainly not the modern. The millennials are not into corned beef.
No.
Every year, thousands of Irish graduates like myself travel to America on 12-month J-1 visas. Though it is a violation of the visa's terms, working in services is an economic reality for many. Lucky for us, it seems most American cities have their own take on a particular type of pub. When looking for work, it's here that we can at least count on consideration, regardless of previous experience.
When I came to America first, there was 44 Blarney Stones, there was 9 Blarney Rocks, there was
right. Yeah.
6 Killarney Roses, there was 28 McCann's Bars, and they had steam tables.
Okay.
And they specialized in corned beef, brisket of beef, ham, and that type of food on the steam table.
Okay.
And they were very successful, but there's not one of those stores left in Manhattan.
Though there has been a decrease in numbers, Irish bars still exist. During my own time working in one, the corned beef brisket caught my attention. Around St. Patrick's Day, you may find other bars adapting their standard menus to include some variant on a corned beef, cabbage, and potato dish. In specifically Irish bars, it seems to be an important part of the experience. I began to wonder why it was such a significant dish. I decided to ask around.
All right, okay. Yeah. And why are you picking such a well-travelled road of a subject?
You mean the corned beef and things like that?
Yeah, it's been beaten to death, that road. Could you not come up with something more...
Clearly, I'm not the first to ask. That was Peter O'Connell from Molly Shabin in Gramercy in Manhattan. Molly's opened in 1960, in the same era as the numerous Blarney Rocks and Stones Peter just mentioned. These days, it still serves corned beef and cabbage, as well as a very particular vision of Ireland, complete with sawdust shavings on the floor. In my mind, the term corned beef meant shredded meat in a tin, which you open with a key. Not necessarily something I associated with home. There were a lot of dishes I did associate with home, but I didn't think these would necessarily speak for everyone. And yet, corned beef seemed to be uniquely Irish. Soon, what had started out as a simple question about a particular dish evolved into discussions on identity, nostalgia, and saltpeter. According to Justin McManus from the Peter McManus Cafe on 7th Avenue and 19th, also in Manhattan, the dish goes back a lot further than the 1960s. The Peter McManus Cafe is actually a bar and has stayed in the McManus family since opening in 1910. Here's Justin's take on corned beef in New York.
In New York Irish, and also like there was a big Jewish population. A lot of them actually shared housing. They'd have these, what they call these like tenement apartments. You know, they would, what now you would probably have, you know, if you look at a building, maybe one apartment on the floor for like a couple. They probably had 4 or 5 whole families living in these things, sharing one bathroom, you know, per floor. You know, all you know, every room just had enough, you know, space for a bed for you to lie down, you know, and maybe a small closet you shared too, where you lived out of a suitcase. We call it corned beef, and in Jewish it's called brisket. Mm. And but you know, it was that same piece of meat. So that you see a lot of like crossovers with a lot of you know, similar things. But it was that and the cabbage, you know, like so you'd have corned beef and it's traditionally served with cabbage, which is another vegetable that had so much of that was cheap, but it was very bitter and sour, so you had to, you know, boil it. You could boil it almost in the same pot. And the same thing, and of course, the potatoes, which is always going to be something a good Irishman wants to eat. So, no matter where. So those three things would be boiled together. Every, you know, Irish American pub is going to have a good, tasty corned beef sandwich, you know, and that they make. They want to do it right.
So it seems this is a dish people would have prepared with their new neighbours, making the best of what they had. Sounds nice. According to Peter Colin, from Colin's Meats in the English Market here in Cork, they may even have hummed a tune while they were at it.
One of them, if I remember reading, it was called My Yee Dish.
Oh, Colleen.
I could drive you frantic, I'm a loving dog. Say you'll be my Yiddish or Colleen. I'll be one romantic. I'll
Here is a story which feels familiar. The fate of the Irish immigrant to America is a popular fable on both sides of the Atlantic. On closer inspection, however, it seems the actual origin of this particular cured myth may be a little bit more complicated. Here's Regina Sexton, a published author and food and culinary historian specialising in 18th century foodways.
Cork has a very strong connection with salted or corned beef, right, as we call it. And I suppose for a number of reasons, but the main reason would be an economic one. Mm. That's based on the trading, the food trade that was happening between Cork and the rest of the world, in particular the transatlantic trade in the 18th century.
Okay.
Now, there was always foods going out of Cork,
right,
because Cork is special in a number of ways. It's kind of the Golden Vale and so on. So what it produces very, very well in the agricultural hinterland around the city and the county and the counties surrounding it is cattle, and in particular beef cattle and dairy cattle.
I see. Okay.
So the area produces superlative ingredients in the form of meat and dairy produce, like butter in particular, cream and cheeses. The British Empire realised that Cork was a very important point, particularly a sheltered port for their naval fleets. It was also a defensive point around the harbour. There's many defensive sort of forts and so on that are associated with navy and naval activity.
Mm.
And also, of course, it was a good place to provision for all of those fleets of ships that were leaving the old world and going across to America.
Okay.
So it was a great place. So they could stop in Cork and they could provision their ships.
Mm.
And what they provisioned with, of course, were things to eat themselves en route, but also things to trade with the new world.
Yes.
So they were selling both to North and South America.
It seems that once corned beef did arrive in the United States, it caught on very quickly, as Peter Collin describes.
It was 1762, right? Was the first parade, which, and of course, it was predominantly then celebrated with corned beef and cabbage throughout the states, New York. And in fact, just on a point of that, President Lincoln's inauguration dinner, right? Which was the 4th of March, 1861, right?
Okay.
He had corned beef and cabbage.
No way.
So now we know that corned beef on St. Patrick's Day was traditional from day one. That said, we're still not entirely clear on the preparation of this celebrated dish. What is corned beef and cured meat in general? Here's Regina with a more detailed description.
So in particular, if you're thinking about a large animal, like a cow, I don't know if you've ever seen the slaughter of that, but once you slaughter the animal, you do need to have a whole system swing into place, because you don't want to waste anything, and you want to make good use of things. And in the days before refrigeration, the main preserving ingredient would be salt.
Yes.
And later on,
like most traditional staples, it seems corned beef was born of necessity. Modern technology and transport have removed the dish from its original context. However, if necessity is the mother of invention, then modernity and surplus give rise to nostalgia. Peter Collin describes the modern approach to corned beef preparation.
First of all, it's processed and cut into joints.
Yes.
Usually deboned. The briskets for rolling, and they'd be rolled similar to a Swiss roll. Right?
Yeah.
It would resemble that, because you'd have both fat and meat when you'd slice it.
Okay.
Right? That was purely for the people that would like it that way. The top side, silver side, and tail end would be a very lean cut with a selvage of fat on the outside, which would help the flavour. You know, we immerse it in brine. We put it in brine, salted water.
Yes.
The preparation for that is salt, some brown sugar. There was a time they used to use saltpeter. But that's
kind of gone.
That's gone. That was for pigmentation, right? And that faded out in the 70s in the Troubles in Ireland, because remember, if anybody strange went to the, you have to go to the chemist,
right?
Yeah. If somebody strange went to the chemist and asked for saltpeter,
yeah.
they they'd say, we'll do that for you now. And they'd phone the police, and two detectives arrived, you know, what do they want to smell beef for?
It seems that subsequently, corned beef has become quite a popular item here in Cork City, even if its popularity has ebbed and flowed.
So hence, it's very much a huge thing again. We would sell three to £400 weight of beef and sell every week.
Wow. Okay.
You know?
As we're beginning to find out, there are at least two sides to each story. While corned beef may still fetch between 5 and 6 euro per kilogram in the English market, against 8 euro per kilogram for pork loin, its true price was much higher up on the hill in the suburbs of North Cork. Here's Regina again.
So the slaughtering was concentrated in the winter months, and it's hundreds of thousands of heads of cattle are slaughtered in a very small period of time. Mm. So you can imagine what Cork was like at that point, if the northern suburbs full of slaughterhouses and abattoirs. If you think about noises, smells, the whole atmosphere and so on, it must have been extraordinary.
Yeah.
And you had a whole load of sort of ancillary industries building up from that, like hide, bone, horn, making buttons, all that sort of stuff, gut, blood.
So corned beef is just one product for one of a number of codependent industries. Here, Regina describes in similar detail another Cork delicacy, one that may be less familiar stateside.
The third chamber was called book tripe.
Okay.
And it looked like a book because it was full of leaves.
Okay.
And if you were trying to sell that, you had to clean digested grass from each of the leaves. So it was too labour intensive.
I see.
And then the fourth chamber was called the black because it was dark in colour and there was kind of they were put off by the colour of it.
If anyone at home is thinking this is not the tripe I know and love, the most recognisable form of tripe is in fact the second chamber of the cow's stomach, known as honeycomb tripe. So why is one appendage cherished above another? Tripe is a notoriously versatile ingredient, and it has been unfairly overlooked, given it and corned beef's shared heritage here in industrial Cork. In any case, what they do show us is that the origins of beloved staples and fondly remembered flavours are often less romantic than we think. But ultimately, do people care? When we find ourselves in a new city, we often want something that reminds us of home. Even today, arriving in America is often a jarring experience. Jack McGarry is the founder of the Dead Rabbit, a more modern Irish bar in Lower Manhattan. Here's his account of his first few days in New York.
I came over to New York, and obviously, like when you've just arrived over here, it was 7 years ago, and you're walking through Times Square and all these kind of places, and you're seeing these like hooligans and all this kind of Irish pubs knocking around. You're going into them, and there's just nothing Irish about them. You know, an Irish flag outside the front door, and they serve a pint of Guinness, and maybe they have somebody behind the bar that's Irish. A lot of these Irish American bars are there for profit. They're there for they're there to make money, and in a lot of ways an Irish bar in that type of area in New York, and it's the same all over the world. For me, they're like Disneyland Irish bars.
Jack does have a point. No one likes to feel like something is being sold back to them, especially if it feels like a cheap imitation. That said, why would you outside of Ireland classify a bar as Irish, other than to make a statement to potential customers? Is it that the bar is the same as those in Ireland? Are all bars in Ireland the same? Aside from making a geographical statement, I would feel a little weird claiming one thing is Irish and another isn't. As we've heard, corned beef comes from Ireland, and yet its identity is more global and complex. Here's Regina again.
So even when the beef is going into America,
yes,
out of Cork, you know, we talked about the hierarchy in terms of fresh and salted.
Yes.
Even when the beef has been salted in Cork, there's a hierarchy in the salted meats as well.
Okay, yeah.
So the best ones would be ones that they called, going into the American market, would be called planter's beef.
Yes, okay.
Or mess beef.
Right.
And then they had cargo beef.
Okay.
And best cargo beef. And that was the hierarchy. So planter's was the best. The mess beef and the cargo beef.
Okay.
And what made the difference between them was the level of leanness or fat.
This is interesting. Whatever section in this hierarchy Irish immigrants could afford to buy from probably said a lot about their social standing. But this is not unique to Irish immigrants. The struggles of the Irish in America are well publicised, but ultimately they were only one group amongst a huge number of immigrants from all over the world. As Justin mentioned earlier, it wasn't only the Irish who were buying corned beef. Once again, corned beef tells a complex and layered story. Can the same be said of Irish bars?
I mean, for me, an Irish bar, I was reading a book recently and it was in reference to, I think the book was called The Third Place. And it's basically called the first place the home place and the second place the workplace. And the third place was where you went to seek refuge. So for a lot of people that would be like yoga or running or whatever, but definitely in Ireland, that third place was the pub. The pub was sort of like the community centre where people came together.
This makes a lot of sense. Just as people would have gravitated towards certain foods that were accessible and familiar, they may well have flocked to bars that provided a similar space to those back home. I wonder if this is a specifically Irish thing to do, however. Is this not a claim any variety of bar anywhere in the world could make? Angie Kohler runs the Erin Rose in New Orleans. Here is her take on what makes the bar Irish.
So I'm born and raised in the French Quarter. And so New Orleans is pretty much in my blood, from dancing in the streets, listening to brass music, to eating great food, to celebrating camaraderie with all kinds of different walks of life that just exude fun and great spirit. That's pretty much the background. And as far as my take on the characteristics of an Irish pub, it's a sense of great community. So with that, I look at it as New Orleans and Irish heritage as being one and the same.
On the face of things, this is quite a relaxed definition. That said, the Erin Rose herself is a very clearly defined personality.
She is the matriarch of 811 Conti, her address, and I would consider her the daughter that I've never had. I'm my husband and I act as guardians of her, is what we call, because she's an entity on her own, you know. So whether if you think of Brigitte from Kildare, or you think of things like that, I look at Erin Rose as this special entity that looks out for all those looking to have a good time and keep it light, keep it fun, and keep it real.
Personally, I would wonder whether one needs to keep it fun or real if they want to consider themselves Irish, or whether Irishness is a prerequisite for keeping it light. That said, I do admire Angie's open-minded attitude to the question. In any case, it is getting hard to justify claiming any one characteristic or menu item as uniquely Irish. As it turns out, the less fortunate Irish weren't the only ones eating corned beef.
So that's interesting too, because when it's going into America, you'll see a lot of the salted beef going into America is bought by the white planters,
yes.
Hence salted planters beef.
Yes.
And a lot of those planters are concerned with the sugar plantations and so on. And the beef will make its way to the workers,
right.
The slave populations,
yeah.
In some instances, for special occasions for them.
Yes, okay.
Like the cargo version.
I see, okay.
So in many ways, if you want to do a strange, stretched comparison between the poor Irish in Ireland in the 19th century
and
the oppressed, much more oppressed populations and slaves.
I would view this not so much as a comparison, but more as evidence of how small the world was and still is. Here we have a link between something familiar and a part of history many want to distance themselves from. Returning to the Irish-American population again, today, it is 7 times larger than that of Ireland itself. This makes for a diffused and complex identity, which doesn't really bear measurement in bars and briskets. Even within Ireland itself, there is a multiplicity which belies the idea of a single culture. Besides, as Peter O'Connell maintains, corned beef has had its day.
That the people use their cookers in their apartments for storage space. They eat out.
Yeah.
But now we have competition from Postmates, from all the
it
delivery
is true
services.
That we now have much more choice. These days, the dishes someone might grow up with in Ireland are much more varied. In the end, it all comes down to context. To finish up, here's Regina again.
So, like a really popular dish in Ireland, up until quite recently, was bacon and cabbage and potatoes.
Mm, yes.
You know, that would have been part of the repertoire of most Irish people's weekly kind of dinners and so on. You'd have bacon and cabbage and potatoes.
Mm.
If you think about it, it's a salted meat and it's a carbohydrate and it's a vegetable.
Yeah,
that's okay. What it is. And the American bacon and cabbage, or corned beef and cabbage, is the same thing, really. It's a salted meat. It's potatoes, and it's the brassica, which is the cabbage.
Okay.
But I suppose the one thread that does connect immigrants is that food is a comforting thing, and it's imbued with all sorts of complicated psychological things like emotion and nostalgia, and it reminds you of things, and it brings you places, and so on. So it has a power in that sense.
Mm.
So what the immigrant creates in terms of food, maybe not so much what's actually on the plate, but it's the power that construction has for them in a psychological and an emotional way.
So, in the end, corned beef didn't stir any of the psychological associations I brought with me to America. But then again, times have changed. Thank you to all of the interviewees and to everyone at Heritage Radio Network. Special thanks to Susan McKeown and Lawrence Klamberg for their help in tracking down Walter Van Brunt's recording. Be sure to check out their Irish-Yiddish folk fusion album, Saints and Zaddicks.